From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Observers in the court battle over same-sex marriage in Utah are becoming familiar with some of the judges on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. It's usually the Supreme Court that gets the attention and the speculation, but people are looking for clues as to how the appeals court may rule on this case, so they were listening very carefully to the questions the judges were asking during the oral arguments phase in this case last week. It's hard to make an exact interpretation, but most said it seemed the three judges on the panel were split, one leaning to the state, one leaning to the plaintiffs, and one judge, well, he seemed undecided. Today in the program, we're breaking down some of these arguments. We'll have our own panel of experts with us to talk about what happened and, of course, what happens next after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the legal questions and the oral arguments playing out in the ongoing battle over same-sex marriage in Utah. In December, Judge Robert Shelby ruled Utah's marriage ban, Amendment 3, unconstitutional. The state is appealing the ruling, of course, and last week both sides made their case to a three-judge panel of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. A similar process also played out yesterday in Denver as the state of Oklahoma is appealing a similar ruling overturning its ban on same-sex marriage. So we're broadcasting live at the Wasatch Retreat and Conference Center in downtown Salt Lake City, and actually we're taking advantage of a gathering of Utah lawyers with the Salt Lake County Bar Association who wanted to work through this case, Kitchen versus Herbert, and they've allowed us to be a part of it. So we have a very informed audience with us today, and there is a risk the discussion won't be technical enough for them, or it may be too technical for those listening, but we'll try and make it as clear as we can. And there's a lot to talk about, so let's get started. Cliff Roski is with us. He's a professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, where he teaches courses on constitutional law, criminal law, and family law. And Professor, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Bill Duncan is also with us, the director of the Sutherland Institute's Center for Family and Society. And Bill Duncan, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin with a basic question about just how important are these oral arguments in the scheme of things in cases like this? I mean, a lot of the technical questions are already worked out in the briefs, a lot of the paper going back and forth. So what does the oral argument really do? Cliff Roski?
Well, I think your instinct is right that the written arguments, the briefing, is probably the most significant thing that happens in the process. But really, when you walk into a federal appeals court at oral argument, you kind of start where the briefing ends. The judges are now thinking about what opinion they might write, and they're sort of, they can take that opportunity to try out different arguments and see where a strength or a weakness might be. So really the oral arguments are as important as the judges want to make them, and I think it was quite clear in this case that the judges were incredibly well prepared and really wanted to push hard on the attorneys on both sides.
I think that's right. And one of the things that's interesting, I think, is that the judges can try out – there's a couple of things judges can be trying to do in an oral argument. One is to try and get concessions to say, hey, you know, I want you to respond in person to the claim of the other side. Do you agree? And that could be important to the case. The other thing I think that could be useful is that judges can sort of try out their own ideas and sort of see how it sounds, you know, as they're as they get responses from the attorneys. Is this something you know, worth including in the opinion? There were a couple of things in this oral argument that were really new, or that weren't not precisely new, but hadn't been focused on much in the briefing, and that kind of thing was clearly happening here.
Yeah, I want to get what you mean by that as we go. The attorneys on both sides, just in terms of their, you know, performance, how did they do? Peggy Tomczyk, she represents the plaintiffs. How did she do?
I thought the attorneys on both sides were very effective, and the judges really put tough questions to the attorneys on both sides. So, of course, when you have three judges coming at a tough case like this from different perspectives and pushing as hard as they can with all the preparation that they've done and their clerks, they're going to, you know, put the attorneys in a tough spot every once in a while. There were clearly some points of disagreement between some of the judges and the state and the plaintiffs. So, but I really thought that the state's attorney and Peggy Tomsek for the plaintiffs did very well.
Bill Duncan, Gene Scheer, of course, he represented the state. And the attorney general sort of hired outside of the state for this case. So I guess the question was, were the briefs or was the oral argument that he made, was that better because of what, because of that, that they hired outside?
I think so. There have been these kinds of cases been going on for, you know, almost 20 years now, clearly more than that, but in earnest over the last couple of decades. And I would say that the amount of preparation, the care that in the briefing, and clearly the oral advocacy was the best that I think I've ever seen in a case like this. It's very commonplace in continuing legal education classes for someone to say that, you know, you can't win a case in oral argument, but you can lose it. Clearly, neither side lost in this case. They both did a good job. But I think it is somewhat unique that the very high quality of Gene's work in this case.
So give us a sort of a lay of the land of these three judges. You've got Paul Kelly Jr., appointed by President Bush Sr. You've got Carlos Lucero, appointed by President Clinton. You've got Jerome A. Holmes, appointed by President Bush Jr. Do you have a sense of where, I mean, I mentioned in the introduction, people are getting some sense of where they are. You've got Kelly, who seems to be leaning toward the state. You've got Lucero, who seems to be leaning toward the plaintiffs. And you've got Holmes somewhere in the middle of that. Is that a correct assessment, the way you folks are reading it?
Well, I think that seems largely right. In the middle is probably not precisely the right term. And I think what I think we saw happening is that Judge Lucero was asking questions that were difficult to the state.
Yeah.
And then sort of softballs for the plaintiffs, and Judge Kelly kind of less inserting himself less than the other judges, and Judge Holmes asking hard questions of both sides, and specifically raising some interesting questions, I think, about the levels of scrutiny that suggest that he easily can see a way to rule either way. So I think that's why. I don't know that we know that he's undecided, but he's clearly thought a lot about both sides and the way to get either kind of decision.
And I would agree with that. I do think that, as expected, Judge Lucero had most of the tough questions for the state, that Judge Kelly asked fewer questions than Judge Lucero, but almost all of his hard questions were for the plaintiff. He, in the Utah case, I believe, asked only one question to the state, which was more of a really open question invitation. He said, are there any disputed issues of fact in this case? The normal expected answer to that would have been yes, because that would mean that reversal was in order. But because the state had already taken the position that there were no factual disputes, they said no. And that was pretty much the end of Judge Kelly's questions for the state. So, Judge Holmes was very active in questioning both sides.
There's a question I want to get at, and that is, what exactly is the standard the court is going to apply to this case? This seemed the really big deal. Cliff Roske, you've talked about how Judge Holmes seemed to wonder, and Bill Duncan, you too, what that standard is. Should it be, and for those who are sort of unfamiliar with all of this, should it be a high standard or should it be a low standard? Take us through that idea, because this seemed an important point for these judges.
It was apparently the critical point for Judge Holmes. There are, as you said, certain exceptional laws, either that discriminate against particular groups of people or burden very important rights, are subject to a higher level of scrutiny. The courts are suspicious of those laws, and they review them very carefully. And in those cases, the burden of proof would rest on the state to justify that law. But most laws are not subject to this higher level of review. and the burden would rest on the plaintiffs to prove that the law was unconstitutional. And Judge Holmes at one point flatly said, well, I think the plaintiffs lose if we apply the normal level of review, the low level.
Which is called rational basis.
Yeah, it's called rational basis review. He said, I think you lose under rational basis review because there's a debate over whether same-sex parents, he's speaking now, are as good parents as heterosexual parents. There are some studies that say yes, indeed many studies, but those studies have been criticized. He says, conversely to the state, if we apply a higher level of review, known as heightened scrutiny, then I think the state loses because while there's some debate over these studies, there's not much debate and you're not going to bear this burden of proof. So then, of course, the million-dollar question becomes what level of scrutiny would apply, and Judge Holmes was very active on that issue as well.
So the idea that gay parenting could be detrimental for children or that heterosexual parenting is ideal parenting, that's an idea that could fit under this rational basis theory?
It could. I think the way to understand it is, and this is one of the more surprising pieces of the oral argument from my perspective, is that how much attention was paid to levels of scrutiny, since that's not an important part of the Supreme Court decision in the Windsor case from last summer, where the court didn't deal with that issue at all. Now, the circuit is which the Supreme Court seems largely to have abandoned, but this was important. And I think what's important to think about is the reason, the context in which these parenting studies and social science and these things generally come up is if the state, when the court picks a level of scrutiny they're going to apply to this case, that in turn creates a burden on the state to show some kind of justification for the law, and the question will be whether it's a really extremely compelling justification if the court treats the distinction similar to race, or a very, you know, just kind of it's arguable that, you know, as it would do if it applied the lowest level. So that's the context in which this comes up. What kind of proof do you have to show? What kind of justification does the state have to have? And those studies, the studies are not. I think this is what we're hearing is those studies don't seem to be the kind of thing that you would say would be compelling, because that would be, it would have to be some kind of overwhelming proof that something's happening.
But didn't they think those were compelling up until 6:30 before the oral argument? I mean, and let's point this out. I mean, at 6:30 the night before these oral argument, Utah's attorney general reportedly sends a letter to the court saying they are no longer going to rely on those studies, or in particular the study of Mark Regneris of the University of Texas. That seems odd.
I think so. It was odd to me. I don't know if others agree, but I think what's happening there is that there's always a question about whether or not it's not surprising me that they would be trying to sort of affect what's going on in oral argument a little bit and to take off the table some kind of assertion that the state really is. The state's never said it's part of our case. It's sort of core to our case that whether or not Mark Regneris' study is correct, right? It's just one. It's an argument that this is an arguable phenomenon. We just don't know what's going to happen. This is the kind of thing that counsels caution, etc. But there's always the possibility that someone will understand, and clearly, many of us have seen that this has happened. I would say mischaracterize the study as saying there is a difference between opposite sex and same sex couples in terms of parenting. That's dispositive. End of story. And I think that letter was meant to clarify that's not what we're saying in this case. And I think it actually worked. I think it actually kept the social science discussion and oral argument from being a discussion of sample sizes and randomness and comparison groups and all of those things. It was, you know, got a laugh line, but other than that, it ended up not being that important in the oral argument. I think probably as a result of that letter, so I think it ended up being wise, although it was different.
What do you make of the fact that happened? How significant is it? It dramatic and unusual is what you've said.
Yeah, I was quite surprised. I got off a plane to Denver and my phone starts sort of blowing up with notifications about this letter. Just, you know, not much more than 12 hours before oral argument began. And I think I would agree that distancing themselves from one particular study about parenting is not a very significant move. The study has been criticized and become controversial, and was recently it drew a lot of attention in Michigan in a trial where the study's lead author was put on the stand. And but there were a couple of things about the letter that I found quite unusual. The first is that the explanation for the letter was that it was in response to recent press coverage. And I take that to be a reference to, I think, 2 days, no, I guess 5 days earlier in the Sunday Salt Lake Tribune.
Yeah, an op-ed piece.
An op-ed piece had been published criticizing the attorney general for relying on that study and suggesting that that was unethical. And the notion that an attorney would respond to an op-ed about the way they're litigating a case in the case before the court, I found quite unusual. And then the other thing was the explanation for why they were disavowing reliance on this study, which was it didn't just say, well, this study is not central to our case. There are many studies. They said our principal concern in this case is not that the children of same-sex couples, but the children of heterosexual couples, that the Utah's laws banning same-sex marriage are designed to protect the children of heterosexual parents. And as Judge Lucero sort of jumped in on this point and said, I just don't understand that. I thought that this was about children and being better off with heterosexual parents. And if you're not, you know, making that claim. And in fact, Judge Holmes also said, wait, you're backpedaling from that claim now that heterosexual parents are better than same-sex parents? I thought that was your whole argument under rational basis review. There's a debate about that and you win. But if you're not having that debate, what debate are you having?
Well, he said this. He said, what's left of the support for your theory, if anything, then?
Yeah.
How did you read that then?
Well, I think I was sort of somewhat surprised in a similar way. It probably shows there's some cynicism going on, the thinking that the public opinion is influencing this case more than it probably ought to. But one of the things I think it's somewhat interesting is that there really are two separate questions, and this has been really thorny as we've tried to talk about the social science data such as it is on the question, and that is, there's a question of whether or not orientation makes one a bad or a good parent, which I think the state has never really spent much time talking about. And then the question of whether or not there is a family structure that's optimal for children, which the state has suggested. And, of course, there are weaknesses in the Mark Regnera study on that question because, there's just only so much you can do with the random sample he had. So I think the state is trying to clarify that we're not talking about a parenting contest between gay people and straight people, right? To be too blunt about it, but rather about whether or not the state can continue to recognize in its law a legal institution that has had the purpose, arguably, I think I would argue, has had the purpose of connecting mothers and fathers to children.
But what happens to your side if the rational basis standard gets applied?
To the state's position?
Yes, to the state's position.
Well, I think that's what they've been arguing for, and if rational basis is applied as it has traditionally been understood, it's kind of an easy case, but that's because rational basis almost always is very sympathetic to the state's position because they only have to show there's some conceivable basis for the law to be upheld. Well, the reason I'm hedging and not saying that we win is that that's presumably the standard that's been applied, like in the Windsor case over the summer, in a number of the cases that we've seen in the district court since then. And the courts have said, well, we're applying rational basis scrutiny, and you still don't win. Now, I think it's arguable that they're actually applying rational basis scrutiny.
I thought it was interesting that one of the judges, I can't remember which, mentioned that if the court considers anything above rational basis, he said, you lose, right? He said that. And Scheer said he didn't concede that point. He said the court can also rule on common sense. What does he mean by that?
I mean, I take his point to be that without producing a strong consensus of studies or something like that, that the state could still satisfy even a higher level of scrutiny by making a sort of an argument from logic. This was, I think, one of the less convincing moments of the state's case for a number of reasons. One is, when you move into the world of heightened scrutiny, there has to be a very tight fit between the law that you have and the goal that you're announcing. So, for example, if the goal is procreation, well, then you'd have to have a very narrow fit. That is, people who want to procreate and are able to procreate would be able to marry, but other people would not. That's not the law. It's never been the law in any state. And so it's pretty clear that this law would fail on a procreation analysis. And similarly with a parenting analysis, of course, people can get married without being parents, and people can be parents without getting married. And so it's very hard to see how once the burden shifts to the state and you need that tight fit between the law and the state's goal, how the state would ever prevail.
So how... when do we know they've decided?
When they tell us they've
decided. Is that right? I mean, absolutely. They'll say, we decided. What? At some point, they're going to say, oh, this is the level of scrutiny we're going to apply. And we'll find out in the ruling?
That's right. Yeah. So right now, they're talking to each other and to the clerks and drafting memos to each other, possibly drafting the opinion already in one or both cases. Given that there are two cases before them on the same issue and the same panel of judges, we will probably see not just the ruling but the opinion in both cases on the same day at the same moment.
Cliff Roske is with us. He's a law professor at the University of Utah. Bill Duncan, also here, director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society. Our program today is a partnership with the Salt Lake County Bar Association. We're broadcasting live from the Wasatch Retreat and Conference Center in downtown Salt Lake City. And we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the legal questions at the heart of the ongoing court battle over same-sex marriage in Utah. Last week, both sides presented their case to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. So we're broadcasting live today from downtown Salt Lake City, an audience of experts here, lawyers here, but trying to wade through the technical stuff and explore just what happened, the arguments made, and what we can tell from the questions asked by the panel of judges. We have with us Cliff Roske, a professor of law at the University of Utah, and Bill Duncan, director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society. So let's get into the particulars of this idea of strict scrutiny or heightened scrutiny, if they apply that as a standard. I wanted to start with this idea of, Cliff Roske, you say that Judge Holmes seemed to see this idea of a protected class. This issue is not so much a matter of discrimination against gay people, but more general sex discrimination. Lay this part of the argument out for us, if you would.
I think was probably, for me, the biggest surprise in both of the oral arguments was to hear Judge Holmes pressing hard on the idea that by banning same-sex couples from marrying, the state of Utah or Oklahoma is discriminating based on sex or gender, not sexual orientation. That is, the conventional understanding of these laws is that they discriminate based on sexual orientation against gay people and lesbians as a group. They favor heterosexuals over gays. But his claim is that the law discriminates based on sex. So the easiest way to understand this is to say a woman or two women walk into the county clerk's office and they say, "We'd like a marriage license, please." And the clerk says, "No." And they say, why? What's the answer? Well, the answer is that they're both female, and that if one of them were male, then they would get their marriage license. And so Judge Holmes says, isn't that discrimination based on sex? Same-sex couples can't get married. Different-sex couples can. And so that's sort of where the argument begins, and that's where it really began last week in the Utah case.
Well, and does that lead us to this question? Judge Lucero asked, why is this case any different from Loving, which was a reference, of course, to the Loving versus Virginia case. It's a landmark decision by the Supreme Court. This was in 1967, which did away with interracial marriage laws. And it was a case that, of course, originated in Virginia. How is that Loving case going to play out in this particular case as you're seeing it?
It's a powerful analogy. It's come up a lot in the district court opinions, and sometimes in almost a humorous way, where the court's sort of just going on and on about, you know, this is exactly like Loving, and it's important analogical reasoning, but it's not an important determinant of the decision in this case, because Loving is, as you know, involved a criminal statute that punished people for being in interracial marriages, and this is a definitional question that has to do with, is the state allowed to retain an understanding of marriage that's always been part of the law from time immemorial? And so it has the negative effect as well, of course, of tarring those who disagree with the position that marriage ought to be redefined, include same-sex couples, of being, you know, essentially the same kind of people as those who supported interracial marriage bans. And that's it's a powerful weapon, but it is a weapon. It's not really a legal reasoning that would be very applicable here. It's also sort of hard. Sex discrimination is a very difficult area, and that's why I think the court treats it as intermediate. It's not the same as race, which, you know, Loving would was a strict scrutiny case because of the racial discrimination, and probably because of the fundamental right to marry. And sex discrimination doesn't fit that so well. Like Justice Ginsburg has said that, a community made up of both genders is different from a community made up of just one, and so that seems to go to Gene's point about common sense. So we can see that there's something different here than sex discrimination being, you know, the mere invocation of the person's gender is enough to invalidate the law inherently. That seems very hard to buy.
Do you get a sense that Judge Holmes wants to use Loving?
Well, you know, it's always hard to infer from the questions a judge asks at oral argument what he or she wants to do. But I did think, I was sort of listening in the Oklahoma case for whether this came up again or whether he was just sort of toying around with the idea, and it did. In particular, he took the argument one step further yesterday during the Oklahoma argument. So I articulated the basic sex discrimination claim. The traditional response is, well, this law doesn't discriminate based on sex because it treats men and women equally. It doesn't burden men as a group or women as a group, so it's not sex discrimination. And yesterday, Judge Holmes responded to that claim by saying, but that's exactly what the state of Virginia said in Loving. They said, blacks can't marry whites and whites can't marry blacks. And the state of Virginia said, but we punish them equally, so it's not race discrimination. We classify based on race, but we don't burden one class or another. And the Supreme Court said, the fact that the law applies equally to races would not make the law immune from this strict scrutiny. We would still look very suspiciously at any law that classifies based on race, and this law does, and it fails. To hear Judge Holmes sort of raise the argument twice, in both arguments, and then take it one step further, that begins to sound like he's sort of trying it out and seeing where it goes. Now, of course, the state had an answer to that. It's all rather involved. But
Judge Lucero said all of this turned on protected classification, the scrutiny of whether or not this group represents a protected class. Is that right? That's where he's thinking?
Well, it seems like that's possibly what he's thinking. It's what was interesting, though, is there was no real discussion about whether, you know, one was the nature of the class. I mean, are we talked about sex discrimination. We didn't talk about sexual orientation discrimination. So that was an omission that I think would have would have made sense if that was really important, whether there's a protected class or not. I think also that there's a four-part test that the courts have used to determine whether and no questions had to do with that either. So it seems surprising. It would be surprising to me if that turns out to be the crux of the court's decision, since it hasn't been a crucial part of even the briefing, but clearly not the oral argument. But I don't know.
My understanding was that Judge Lucero, at least in the first argument, seemed quite convinced that simply the impact that this law has on children by itself, based on the Supreme Court's decision last summer, would be fatal to the law. He emphasized in both cases, well, let me be perfectly clear. If a same-sex couple is married in another state and they have children that are children of that marriage and they move to either Utah or Oklahoma, how would the state treat those children? And the answer, given was, well, if the child was not biologically related to one of the same-sex couples, which by definition it wouldn't be, then the state would not recognize that person as a parent. And he said, I don't understand how after last summer that could be constitutional, because the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act.
Well, and Justice Kennedy in particular mentioned how this could stigmatize children.
Yes. He said that the Defense of Marriage Act humiliates tens of thousands of children being raised by same-sex couples. This is not gentle language. When a law humiliates tens of thousands of children, it fails. And there's no real clear distinction between the impact of Amendment 3 on such children and the impact of the Defense of Marriage Act. As we wrote in our brief, it's hard to imagine that children either know or care whether the federal government or the state government is humiliating them in that manner.
It's interesting, Bill Duncan. Judge Holmes also mentioned the Kennedy concern in the oral arguments that not recognizing those marriages could be stigmatizing for. Are you worried about that?
Well, I am. It suggests a deep misunderstanding of what's going on in the case, and that part was a little surprising to me. I think one of the things that's worth remembering is that the state's position is that children are. Every child that's born in the world has a mother and father. I mean, that's a given, and that it would be an easy graph to put together. You have a circle, and that's all you have, and that's the set of people who have a mother and father. It's everybody, and so the state is pointing out that all through time, marriage has been understood across cultures, across societies, being a way of encouraging those who create children take responsibility for them, and for those children have a link to both a mother and father, recognizing again the common sense that there are some differences between men and women. And for the court and for Justice Kennedy and for the court this week to try and pretend that away, that reality away, and say, well, these are children of these same-sex couples, when of course one parent has already been excluded from the child's life, whether certainly through a decision of the parents or through technology or something. That's what the state's trying to grapple with. That's what the law of Utah talks about all the time. The legislative brief went on at some length about how there is how in statute after statute after statute, the state is trying to sort of firm up that principle that children deserve to have a relationship with a mother and father, preferably the most stable relationship of marriage.
I wanted to get your reaction to, because some questions have come up as to whether or not maybe Mr. Scheer should have just focused a little bit more intently on the federalism question, the question of states' rights. And he made this argument about a boy's experience with masculinity. Could it be in jeopardy if he were raised by a lesbian couple, for example? He did this right toward the end. I think he knew he was running out of time, and why he went with this material at the end is kind of interesting. And he also referred to an amicus brief that suggested same-sex marriages could, as he put it, further weaken heterosexual men's connection to marriage and their children. And Judge Holmes reacted to those points, and they all did. I'm wondering, why did he... Not that these weren't strong cases, if he thought. Obviously, he thinks they were. But why did he end with that, do you think?
Well, I would just be guessing. But my guess is that...
Was it a mistake to do that?
I don't think so. I think the federalism points are reasonably well understood. I mean, they're, you know, the, this is, comes up constantly. It's constantly an issue and a theme. It's pretty obvious that if the federal government says that every state has to have a certain definition of marriage, that there's a federalism issue there. I mean, that's not entirely surprising. So belaboring that would probably not be a good use of their time. Hmm. The more complicated claims that the state is making about why the state's definition of marriage is justified, that is harder. And I'm guessing that if he feels that the judges were not understanding that argument, spending time clarifying was more valuable than saying, oh, and by the way, the Constitution doesn't give the federal courts the ability to tell states, you know, what their definition of marriage should be. So I think
it just seemed inconsistent to me that the night before the state would ditch that study, and then he would, you know, bring it to a close with points that made
right.
reference to that.
And I actually think they're consistent, and that's the way I understand the letter and that part of the argument, that the state is trying to help the judges understand precisely what they're arguing and what they're not arguing, because what you're not arguing is perhaps more important to make clear. And so I think that's why that came up so often. In the state's presentation, that was, as you say, that was injected. It wasn't required. They weren't required to necessarily bring that up.
What do you think?
I have a very different reading of the state's strategy of not ending on the federalism note. If memory serves, the state sort of tried to begin on the federalism note, and very quickly Judge Holmes jumped in and shot him down, said, didn't the Supreme Court say more than once last summer that whatever definition of marriage a state adopts must comply with the 14th Amendment? And so federalism will not resolve the question here, which is whether or not this law violates the 14th Amendment. And at that point, federalism ceases to shed much light on the question in this particular case. The case last summer was about whether Congress or the states have more authority to define marriage in some ways, but it certainly was not about whether Congress or the states can violate the United States Constitution, which by its own terms is the supreme law of the land. Federalism doesn't allow a state to violate the 14th Amendment. Once that argument has been had, that's the basic point that everyone agrees on, there's not much more in the case to say about federalism. But I do think that it was a mistake for the attorney. I mean, you know, these are all judgment calls. It's easy to sit in the bleachers and second guess attorneys. But to go on for such length about a boy being raised by two mothers and having issues about masculinity, I think he said some version of masculinity or maleness three times, when the judge he's primarily speaking to is concerned that this is a case of sex discrimination. Because the Supreme Court's jurisprudence is very clear that you could classify based on sex, or you could attempt to justify a law based on sex stereotypes. And it sure sounded like sex stereotyping when he's talking about the importance of teaching boys, giving them models of masculinity. And the Supreme Court has said in no uncertain terms, the state may not justify a law based on generalizations about males and females, even if they're true. Because they're not true for every single male or every single female.
Cliff Roske, a law professor at the University of Utah. We have Bill Duncan with us as well of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society. Our program today is a partnership with the Salt Lake County Bar Association. We're broadcasting live from the Wasatch Retreat and Conference Center in downtown Salt Lake City, and we need to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting live from the Wasatch Retreat and Conference Center in downtown Salt Lake City, and we are going over the legal questions at the heart of the ongoing battle over same-sex marriage in Utah. Last week, both sides were able to present their case to a panel of judges with the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. We have with us Cliff Roske, law professor at the University of Utah, and Bill Duncan, director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society. So Judge Holmes said last Thursday that it seemed like the issue before the panel was not the definition of marriage, but whether the state in its exercise of authority may properly deny a same-sex marriage without violating the federal constitution. But then Gene Scheer argued that you can't really have that conversation, he said, until you go ahead and define marriage, which he says is obviously a decision should be left to the states. Bill Duncan, what do you make of that part, this idea that a definition has to be in play?
Sure. I think that's precisely right. I think that was a really strong point of the argument, that there's a degree to which the courts have typically, and this is definitely true of Judge Shelby, have assumed a certain definition and said, well, you know, given this reality that marriage is, as Judge Shelby would say, you know, the state's way of affirming the adult choices about relationships. Given that, it's irrational that you would deny everybody the ability to have that affirmation. And if the state is correct, as I think it is, that the definition of marriage is not just, it can't just be changed sort of based on a judge's individual, you know, sort of thoughts about what it means, then the plaintiffs in the case have a much harder sort of road ahead. They've got to establish that somehow this institution's existed for so long that there's something sort of wrong about that understanding. And this is an important piece of Justice Alito's dissenting opinion in the Windsor case, which I think it was brought up again in this argument. I think it surprised one of the judges, at least.
That he would quote from a dissent,
yeah. Although I don't know why that would be surprising necessarily. He explained why he was mentioning it. But really, this debate is a debate about, you know, what is the meaning of marriage, and then secondarily, you know, who has the opportunity to decide. And sometimes I think that the courts are acting as if this is a simple decision. You either can expand liberty or not. And I think Gene Scheer is trying to point out that, you know, every rights claim has costs. If the court says that you know, everyone has the right to marry the person of their choice, regardless of you know, whether that is a same or opposite sex person, then that will have costs. One of the obvious costs has to do with the opportunity of the child in that relationship to have a legal relationship with the mother and father. But the other significant cost, of course, is the ability of the state to retain some level of accountability to the voters who enacted a law like that. And that's I think, an important thing for him to raise. I think it would have been nice. I think there's more discussion of that, but maybe it seems obvious to everybody.
Cliff Roske, how did you read that part, the argument?
Well, it is clear at some level that the question of what marriage is as a legal matter is at stake. Right. I think what Judge Holmes was initially saying is this is not about, you know, just a little question of you look marriage up in the dictionary. But I think they would all agree that, you know, the Supreme Court has held and announced in about 13 cases that the right to marry is a fundamental right, and any law that infringes on a fundamental right is subject to the highest level of scrutiny.
Scheer conceded that, by the way, that it was a fundamental right. I found that interesting.
Right, and then his answer is, but this isn't marriage within the meaning of that principle. And so that's where you get into this debate about what marriage is. And this came up again in the Oklahoma case, both the state's attorneys saying, well, in all of the previous cases, the Supreme Court has talked about marriage in terms of marriage between a man and a woman and its procreative capacity. And listed cases. And what was significant yesterday is that Judge Holmes jumped on the last case on the list. The attorney mentioned Turner versus Safley, which is a case from Missouri in the 80s involving prison inmates who wanted the right to marry someone while they were incarcerated. And the Supreme Court offered a definition of marriage. They said even considering the constraints of incarceration without any conjugal visits, many important incidents of marriage remain that are constitutionally significant and protected. And if you go through that list, It's a public commitment. It has spiritual significance. It brings tangible and intangible benefits. Obviously, the inmates were not going to engage in any procreative activity while they were incarcerated, and the Supreme Court said they still have the right to marry then, and Judge Holmes pushed that point pretty hard yesterday.
I don't want to spend much time with this because it might be a little arcane to some, but the question of standing and jurisdiction did come up. Did that surprise you?
It did a little bit. I think I had expected the argument to focus a lot more on the Windsor decision and whether that controlled the case, and there was some discussion of that. The standing question is an interesting one, but it appeared to me in both cases, both Utah and Oklahoma, that the attorneys handled it well and showed why they had standing. So I think it is important, and maybe when I think I fell into the trap you'd warned against earlier about just using that term, but by standing we just mean, does a person have the ability, authority to come into court and bring the case?
Yeah.
And if not, because the nature of our Constitution is such that the federal courts don't just get to rule on cases because they're really interesting. They have to have an actual controversy and have to have the jurisdiction over those cases. Otherwise, they shouldn't rule on the case. And so the question is there something that was not done or was done that defeats the ability of the plaintiffs to come in the cases?
But why bring it up?
Well, because the court shouldn't rule on the case at all if they don't have standing. They would need to send the case back. And this had previously happened in the Oklahoma case. Afraid of getting even more complicated, but
don't.
Okay, I
won't. Do you want to say anything about that, Clifford?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is really a question of not whether the plaintiffs have standing. Of course, they're same-sex couples. They either want to get married or they're married in another state. It's very clear that the law is denying them some kind of rights, and they have standing to be in court. The question is whether they're suing the right parties, and whether, upon suing those parties, whether they agree with them or not. So, for example, the Salt Lake County clerk lost in the trial court but hasn't appealed. Yeah. And so if they haven't appealed and they're the ones giving out the marriage licenses, the judges ask, well, why are we here? The governor doesn't give out marriage licenses. The clerk does. So there's interesting questions about whether there's still a controversy that a court should hear.
This seems so crass to ask you, but where do you figure this is headed? I mean, how do you figure they'll rule? Based on what you've heard last Thursday and yesterday.
I would have been reluctant after last Thursday to make a prediction, and frankly, I'm still reluctant, but put me on the spot on
you're
my
you're
radio.
On tape.
So I would say that after hearing Judge Holmes push both the sex discrimination argument and the fundamental rights argument so hard on both days and move both balls sort of forward in the Oklahoma argument, like most people, I'm anticipating, but also hoping for, a 2-1 ruling affirming Judge Shelby's decision. But, of course, that doesn't stop the process.
No. But, Bill Duncan, what do you think?
Well, I agree. It probably is a 2-1 decision. I'm less willing to guess exactly where it would come down. The first time I heard an oral argument in the Supreme Court, I thought, wow, that one side did so good and the other side did so badly, and they had so many questions. And it's clearly that the plaintiffs win this case, and they lost 9-0. So my predictive powers are not worth much. But I think I'm guessing, though, that a lot of the hard questions are really that the court is really trying to take seriously the responsibility to handle this case well. And I think that the questions in oral argument probably tell us less than we think. I think they're really thinking aloud and trying to come to the right decision on the case.
Either way, I guess you're both expecting it to make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that right?
What I would say is there's a very high chance that whichever party were to lose before these three judges, they will then ask the rest of the Tenth Circuit,
which is an 11-member group, right?
Yes, yeah. to come to reconvene and rehear the case. Whether or not the full court would agree to do that depends on what this panel does, and then it very much depends on what the panel and the Tenth Circuit do about whether or not the Supreme Court hears the case. The Supreme Court is the first court in this process that does not have to hear the case. They can simply ignore it. And, of course, at this point, 8 out of 8 courts after last summer have been striking down state same-sex marriage bans. So the members of the court who favor that result might say, why do we need to get involved in this if the lower courts are doing this work for us?
So, but let's say the 10th rules the way you figure it will, and then the 6th doesn't. The court will probably feel like it has to get in and resolve that, I suppose. Is that fair to say?
I think that's right. And I would say that even if the Sixth Circuit were not to rule that way, there's already a circuit split because the Eighth yeah. Circuit has ruled that marriage laws are constitutional. So.
We've got just about a minute left. Let me ask you, in terms of the timing, when do you figure we may hear from the 10th?
Within a couple of months, probably. I mean, this has been an expedited case. The state originally asked for an expedited calendar, and they granted it. They then sought extensions because I think they got more expedition than they bargained for. But having agreed to an expedited calendar, I think the judges will be appropriately diligent about getting this opinion out as quickly as possible. It does become complicated because they have two opinions to write, and then if some of them dissent, you have more than two opinions to write. So
is it conceivable we could have a final Supreme Court decision by the end of 2014?
I don't think so. I think that we may have a decision that the Supreme Court agrees to hear a case by the end of 2014, but I don't think we would see a decision until June of 2015 at the earliest.
Bill?
I think that's probably conceivable. Of course, it's possible. Yeah, of course, it's possible they could do that, but it does seem unlikely it would go that fast.
That's Bill Duncan. He's the director of the Sutherland Institute Center for Family and Society. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Cliff Roske, professor of law at the University of Utah. Cliff, thanks to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Clemens Landau and the Salt Lake County Bar Association. Lewis Downey engineers the show with help from Adrian Moranville. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.